Your questions are, there's about a stack a foot high as I look up here. They're excellent questions, and thank you. There are two that I think are related. One is, I've heard that you received financial support from Iraq. Is this true? The other is, Secretary Powell has said, well, why take Scott Ritter seriously? He's outside the current intelligence loop.
Okay, well, how about that? I'll deal with the Secretary's statement first. Yeah, I agree, Mr. Secretary. I'm outside of the loop. I haven't been in the intelligence business now for 4 years. So, no problem. But as a 12-year veteran of the intelligence service, and as an American citizen, just because I'm no longer in the loop doesn't mean I can't think. And when I'm told by the Bush administration that Iraq, that they know Iraq has chemical weapons, and they know Iraq has biological weapons. Now, I'm a simple Marine. I don't have total grasp of the English language. That implies certainty of knowledge. I'd certainly like to know what the facts are. I don't need to be in the intelligence loop to want to know how they know that so I can support their call for. You know, just think of yourself going to your doctor. And you walk into your doctor and he says, my goodness, you've got a brain tumor in your head. And we lie down on the table right now, I'm lopping off the top of your head, and I'm going to take the brain tumor out. Well, you know, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction have been given to us as the equivalent of a cancer that needs to be excised. Okay, I support that, but wouldn't you say, doctor, could I see the MRI, could I see the x-ray, please? And if the doctor said, no, trust me, just lay down, let me cut off the top of your head, you'd be a damn fool to do so. I don't need to be in the intelligence loop to ask Mr. Powell to show me the information to substantiate his allegations about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Now, about the money thing. I'm going to do my best not to get angry, because trust me, that question gets me boiling mad. But I'm going to try and maintain my sense of humor here. When I resigned, I made a decision to speak out, to try and promote a debate, to try and promote a discussion. Because I recognize that in order for American democracy to function, the people have to get involved. In order for American democracy to function well, the people have to be empowered with information, and I was trying to offer information to the American public so they could have informed discussion and discourse about the situation in Iraq. I wrote a book. It wasn't paid for by the Iraqis, by the way. I wrote a book, and unfortunately, no one read it. I wrote articles. No one read them. I got on TV. Not too many people watched. There needed to be a way to get this message out, and the way I decided to pursue was a documentary film. Now, I came up with the idea, my idea, I'm initiating this, and I traveled around to different media outlets and said, I'd like to produce a documentary. I think I can get into Iraq, and I think I can get the Iraqis to let me interview them, and I can interview inspectors, and I can tell the truth about the inspections, to let the American public see for themselves what the reality is of this process, why it started, what they did, and what the final outcome was. And no one wanted to make this film. Now, I was testifying at a hearing in Congress, and there were some people in the audience. One of the people that stood up afterwards was an American citizen of Iraqi origin from Detroit, a Detroit area businessman. Now, he came up and he said, what are you doing to get your message out? And I said, well, I'm trying to make a documentary. He said, how much would it cost? And I said, $400,000. He said, I'll write the check. And I said, time out. So what's your name? He said, Shakir Al-Khafaji. I said, you're an Iraqi, aren't you? And he said, yes. And I said, whoa, I don't want to go down that path, you know, because I want this film to be pure. But he said, you ain't going to get anybody else to write the check. So I went to Detroit. I sat down with him and his lawyer, and I said, show me where the money's coming from. And he showed me the stocks and bonds that he was liquidating from his own resources to fund the film. And I said, would you sign a contract and a guarantee that says you're not getting a quid pro quo arrangement with the Iraqi government, giving me your money and they're feeding money in the back channel? He signed the assurances. He signed a contract that said he will have no editorial input in the movie. It's my movie. Imagine that, handing me $400,000 and saying, make whatever movie you want to make. That's pretty stunning. But I still wasn't happy. So I went to the FBI. and said, as I make this film, I want an ongoing investigation into the funding here. If you find any reason to believe that there is a quid pro quo arrangement or any other aspect of this that shows this money is tainted, tell me and I will pull the plug on this movie because I will not make anything that can be perceived as a piece of Iraqi propaganda. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a movie made today called In Shifting Sands, and it is the best damn documentary you're going to find about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and the true state of disarmament. And we owed a debt of gratitude to an American citizen named Shakir Al-Khafaji who funded the film. Without him, the American public would not have access to this movie. So that's how I respond to the issue of $400,000. Where can you see the film? We're working on that. You know, the problem is, let me answer that. The film was given a cold shoulder by the American media. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves, too, my God, look at the crowd tonight, and where the hell is the media? Where are they? Besides them.
So, let's do a little roll call and call our media presence. King 5, are you here? Anybody from King 5? Anybody here want to ask King 5 why they're not here tonight? Cairo, are you here? Anybody from Cairo? Anybody want to ask Cairo why they're not here? Cairo Radio is here. Good. Popo! Is Popo here? No one from Popo. Pretty important issue, Popo. Anybody want to ask Popo why they're not here? Seattle PI has reported death manager interrupted from Como. PI. Seattle PI has reported death manager in Iraq with a photographer at this point filing stories in the air. KCCS was here, I know. I think they left earlier if they didn't take this. And Seattle Times. Anyone from Seattle Times? Seattle Times is here.
Okay, so it appears, let me say, the film now is getting the attention I think it deserves, probably because I went to Baghdad and stirred up the pot. It's been sold now to 5 European countries. It's been sold to Canada. Remember, this $400,000, it wasn't a gift. It was a loan. I'm on the hook for it. So, you know, we're trying to sell it and get the money back to pay off the investor. It's opened in San Francisco to rave reviews. It's going to open up in 2 theaters in New York City, and we hope to get it opened up in cities around the United States. And soon, thanks to the generous support of some Hollywood producers, it's going to be out on home video. So hopefully every American will have a chance to see this movie in the near future. Now about the 12th and 13th. Hey, I just threw out an idea. It's up to you to take this idea and run with it. You know, Tony Blair was shown 450,000 reasons why he couldn't accept a war on Bush's terms. You need to show Bush 1 million reasons why you're not going to tolerate his frontal assault on the Constitution of the United States. How you choose to do this is your business. I don't know. I'm not an activist. I think it's a darn good idea, though, to give Senator Robert Byrd and all the other people who feel that the Constitution is something worth fighting for some reinforcements.
Excuse me, Scott. What I'm hearing, think military, I'm hearing October 18th, Congress flies away to work on getting reelected. I'm hearing next weekend is the weekend. I'll be in Washington, D.C. next Friday and Saturday, and I want to know how many will go with me. And I want to know who will use all the networking they've got to get these other people in all the other places, Omaha, it's in Omaha, it's everywhere. How are we going to get the word out? I don't know what this means. I just know if we don't do it now, We're going to be back having candlelight vigils after the war starts. And I'd rather not do that. I think there is a chance. I think there is a chance to stop this thing. And I don't know of another chance. The best one I've heard tonight, it's the one I've been sitting on in my head for 10 years. I'm ready to go.
We're going a little past time. I assume that's okay with everyone. I fully agree with you, Scott, on this matter, but still am curious why a couple of your colleagues, I assume they mean weapons inspector colleagues, are taking the opposite view. Can you respond to that, Leon?
Well, that's a question you need to ask them. I'll just put this in the proper perspective here. There were thousands of weapons inspectors. There were hundreds of them who worked directly with me in my 7-year experience as a weapons inspector. There are a handful who are being trotted out in front of the media to criticize what I'm saying. Some of the leading names, David Kay. Now, David Kay did a darn good job as an inspector in 1991. He left at the end of 1991. How dare David Kay talk about what I did from 1992 to 1998? He has no idea. And yet he's speaking as though he knows what I accomplished, what I'm doing. I don't know why David Kay is doing this. I just know he's not qualified to judge, sit in judgment on the inspections I ran. Dick Spurzel is another one, biological inspector, 1994 to 1998. He never served on an inspection team that I was on. He has no clue what I did. What I can say is everything I've said about what weapons inspections, the result of weapons inspections, are documented fact as set forth in United Nations Security Council documents put forward by the Special Commission. I'm not making this stuff up. We have inspectors out there right now that are saying that they know Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. My God, if they knew it, how come they didn't record it in a document? How come it's not recorded fact? The fact of the matter is you will not find a single United Nations document that says Iraq retains prohibited weaponry. They will say we can't account for weaponry, but they don't retain it. So you have to ask yourself, what's motivating these people? And I always say follow the money. Follow the money, find out who's paying them, and you'll find out that they're being paid by neoconservative think tanks to promote the concept of war with Iraq. And they are sent out to commit politically motivated character assassination of a voice that is arguing against them. Any inspector who served on my team would never say what they're saying, because every inspector who serves on my team is supporting what I'm saying, and they know that what I'm saying is the fact as I knew it. Fox News tried to ambush me on that challenge. I said, find one inspector on my team who will speak out against me. And they went into London and they pulled out a guy named Chris Cobb Smith, who was my deputy. He's a hard-charging former Royal Marine, a hawk, a man who has no fear of danger. And they said, this guy, there's no way he could go along with Ritter. He hasn't flipped. They put Chris Cobb Smith, they were going to give him a full day, put him in front of the camera, give him a whole day of telling the whole world what kind of fool and liar Scott Ritter was. So they put him on in the morning program, camera comes on, and Chris Cobb Smith says, Scott Ritter's absolutely right. Everything he says is the truth, and I agree with 100%. And that was the last time Chris Cobb Smith was in front of the camera.
How can America stay safe when Saddam Hussein wins, and we can say that Saddam Hussein is already winning, if I heard you correctly?
Well, I mean, it's not just America saving face. I think we have to understand that this is a political reality. We have a president named George W. Bush who has committed a tremendous amount of political capital behind the concept of removing Saddam Hussein from power. Okay, he's not, but he unfortunately sits in the White House and he carries the title of president. And we have to deal with this reality. And he's going to be president for at least 2 more years. So, and in that 2 years, he can raise a lot of hell and a lot of havoc. So it's not the United States that has to save face. It's the president that has to save face, especially if you want to stop this war. Now, however unpleasant this concept might be to you sitting in the office, we have to find a way to allow the president to save face. And that's why I brought up the rule of law. The president has said that Saddam must go. Okay, Mr. President, let's indict him. Let's indict Saddam Hussein, hold him accountable for the crimes he's committed against humanity, and then find the mechanism to achieve Saddam's removal. How do we do that? It's pretty easy. Send the inspectors in. Now, the inspectors have been linked with economic sanctions. Now, we all know sanctions are a horrible thing, that sanctions have resulted in an awful toll against the Iraqi civilians, and we want sanctions lifted. Now, sanctions have been justified because they are alleged to compel the Iraqis to comply with their obligation to disarm. But we now know the only thing that got the inspectors back in is the threat of military force. So why continue to abide by the charade of economic sanctions? Get the inspectors back in. When you get a monitoring regime put in place that can effectively monitor how Iraq spends its money, lift the economic sanctions. Then indict Saddam Hussein and his senior leadership as criminals against humanity and pass a new resolution. I'm trying to help you solve this problem. Pass a new resolution that reimposes sanctions on Iraq, but not against the people of Iraq, but the senior leadership of Iraq. And these sanctions can only be lifted when Iraq turns the criminals over to the International Court of Justice. That's how you get rid of Saddam Hussein. That's how you help Bush save face. That's how you stop a war.
Number of people ask this question, Scott. It might help you understand how, knowing what you knew in 1998, explain why you voted for George Bush.
Okay. The fact is, I was disgusted with America's policy on Iraq, especially as it was implemented in 8 years of the Clinton presidency. I saw firsthand how the Clinton presidency lied to me and my fellow inspectors in regards to the threat posed by Iraq. I saw how the Clinton administration sat back and callously ignored the death and suffering of the innocent Iraqi people at the hands of economic sanctions. I was not going to sit back and vote for Al Gore because Al Gore was promising to continue these policies, and in good faith, I couldn't give him my vote. Now, George W. Bush, and this is where I said I'm a pretty simple, naive guy, he got before me and he said a couple of things. He said, you know, I'm a uniter, not a divider. I believed him. He said, I'm going to reach across party lines and bring in the voice of America to represent me on my cabinet. I believed him. He said that we're a powerful nation, but we are going to conduct foreign policy with humility. We will be humble. I believed him. Ladies and gentlemen, I was a sucker, but I tell you what, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. He doesn't get my vote. How about Jim McDermott for president?
Or it says that the people who run those stations don't want this on TV.
thought you've already touched on this. This question says, how do you get the message to the conservative parts of the country? Some of us think Seattle is a little easier on this issue than you mentioned Omaha, but Iowa. Could you just elaborate some more on that?
You get the message to the conservative parts the same way you get the message to the easy parts. You go out there and deliver the message. It's as easy as that, to tell you the truth. I've been traveling all over the country in the last 4 years. When the Congress was, when the Senate was getting ready to have these debates or discussions in the Foreign Affairs Committee, they didn't call anybody with real experience before them. They brought together people who basically had a preordained conclusion to go to war against Iraq. So I got together with a couple people and we said, let's pick Senator Brownback's state, Kansas. Let's go to Senator Lugar's state, Indianapolis. Let's go to Maryland, Horace Albane's state. And we went. We organized town hall functions like this. We invited the press to come. I did interviews. I did meetings with the editorial boards. And people came. People were educated, editorials were written, and we got the message out in the heartland of America. That's the only way to get the message out. You can't rely on the media to do it. You got to do it yourself. You got to get up and show that you have the will to achieve peace. That's the only way. There's no easy way. It's going to be hard, but nothing worth doing is ever easy. It always requires a struggle. This is waging peace. This is a struggle worth the effort.
Will you please run for Congress?
No.
Please explain no-fly zones and the legality or basis thereof.
No-fly zones are not a construct of the United Nations Security Council. They are a construct of the United States of America. The first no-fly zone was imposed in northern Iraq in the spring of 1991, in the aftermath of the crackdown by the Iraqi government of Kurdish insurrection. Over a quarter of a million Kurds fled northern Iraq, some into Iran, some into, most into Turkey. The Turks had their own little Kurdish problem going, and the last thing they needed was a quarter of a million independent-minded Kurds parking in on their territory. So the Turks turned to America and said, get them out of here. There's no place to send them except back to Iraq. But you couldn't ask them to go back to Iraq with the Iraqi military there ready to slaughter them. So the concept of a safe haven was created, and a resolution was passed. But this resolution didn't invoke Chapter 7. This resolution, I believe, invoked Article 1. It talked about the Secretary General appealing to the community of nations to provide humanitarian assistance to the Kurdish people. The United States, Great Britain, and France stepped up and said, we will send in military troops to create a safe haven so the Kurds can return. And they imposed a no-fly zone over northern Iraq to keep Iraqi military helicopters from coming in. So the no-fly zones were created for the purpose of humanitarian intervention. And it was legitimate. But now the no-fly zones are being used for the purpose of destabilizing the regime in Baghdad by denying Baghdad the ability to rule its own sovereign territory. There is no longer widespread oppression of the Kurds taking place. That could be because of the no-fly zone. I don't know, but I do know this. The American Air Force never dropped a single bomb in defense of the Kurdish people. The American Air Force has never dropped a single bomb in defense of the Shia in the south. There is a southern no-fly zone. It was created in 1992. Again, out of pressure from Kuwait, which wanted assurances that the Iraqi military would not come down near the Kuwaiti border and again threaten to invade. They used as an excuse to create this no-fly zone Iraqi oppression of the Shia population in the south. But again, I say, there was no Security Council resolution that this was a unilateral action on the part of the United States. Frankly speaking, the no-fly zones are a violation of international law. There is nothing to support American military aircraft violating the sovereign airspace of Iraq. Nothing whatsoever. And this is very troublesome because we're bombing Iraq. People say we're going to go to war with Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, we're at war with Iraq. We already fly hundreds of combat sorties over Iraqi territory every single day. Several times a week now, we drop bombs on Iraq. The reason why we drop bombs on Iraq is that the Iraqi air defense units are shooting at our airplanes as we fly over the sovereign airspace of Iraq. And we say we're bombing in self-defense, which is okay. Look, If I were an American military officer and my pilots are getting shot at, I'm going to bomb. I'm going to take out the threat. That's understandable. What's not understandable is, why are we there? We shouldn't be there to begin with.
Just a request to repeat the name of the document you cited, the security document that came out a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, it's the National Security Strategy Document.
I believe it's available on the internet, if that helps anyone to know.
There was a part. It's a classified document, but it was there was a partial excerpt of it in the New York Times about a week and a half ago.
Please discuss the chicken hawk advisors to George Bush, Cheney, Pearl, Wolfowitz, etc. Why does Bush ignore the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
This is about as close to a coup as I can think of occurring in modern American history. We have a situation where, I'm not a politician, but I've studied American political history. We have a situation where Bush ran for president, lost the popular vote, and snuck in on a technicality in Florida. He doesn't have a mandate. He does not have a mandate to lead. What happens to a politician when they don't have a mandate? They fall in on their political base, and President Bush's political base is the far-right neoconservative wing of the Republican Party. So he turned to the far-right neoconservative wing of the Republican Party to support him, which means that he plucked these neocons, these Wolfowitzes, these Pearls, these Rumsfelds, people who had no future in American politics. He plucked them out of obscurity and empowered them, gave them important positions. These people are not reflective of mainstream American political thought. They are reflective of right-wing neoconservatives. Now, the sad fact is that these people have been for some time now espousing this philosophy of unilateralism, this Pax Americana. And it's up until recently, it's just been a theory put forward by radical right-wing thinkers. But now that they are empowered, they get to implement this policy as if it's reflective of American thought and American ideal. It's not. They have hijacked the national security of the United States in pursuit of their own politically motivated ideology. And this is wrong. And what makes it morally wrong, in addition to just the crime of assaulting the Constitution, is that we have people pushing for war who never wore the uniform. People who are talking about going to war who found that the Vietnam War was inconvenient for their political future. People who don't know what the cost of war really is. And this, to me, is particularly disturbing.
Let me ask this question and hopefully respond to it if you would first, Jim. If, in your view, if we go to war on Iraq, which way will Turkey, Jordan, and Syria go?
Scott and I had a discussion about this a little earlier. If war starts, one of the unknowns and one of the scariest parts of the whole thing is, it's like throwing a can of gasoline on a bonfire. You don't know what's going to happen. My feeling is if war starts in Iraq and it's not resolved pretty quickly, and I don't think it will be because we're going to have house-to-house fighting in a city the size of Detroit, one house at a time. If we have that going on in Iraq for very long, you're going to watch the Jordanian government, which is already shaky, and tell the king is not, he's a Hashemite, he's of the minority there. You've got the same kind of situations going on all over, and I personally think the Middle East will explode. I think we are really beginning a massive situation over which we have no control. Once you light a fire, you don't know where it goes. It's like lighting a fire, a campfire in the forest. You know, these people who burned down half the forest. They say, well, I was just cooking my hamburgers. But in fact, what happened was it got away from them, and I think that's the real threat of this whole situation, is that all of these countries are the Mubarak, in Egypt, has already said, if you attack over there, I'm going to lose control here. Because he's been fighting this Islamist fundamentalist there for a long time, and Egypt will go, and so forth and so on.
Well, yes, it is exactly what Bush wants. What you know, this is the irony. I was debating this issue with Richard Pearl, the Prince of Darkness, on radio a little while ago. It's not what I call him. It's what he calls himself, by the way, proudly. And we were talking, and that question was asked. And I said, you know, the same response that that Jim just said. I said, you know, the whole region will be destabilized. We have the potential of having, you know, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, et cetera, all collapse into anarchy and chaos, and you know, we're opening a Pandora's box, etc. And the announcer turns to Richard Pearl and says, well, Scott Ritter's just laid out a pretty dreadful scenario here of instability and such. How do you respond to that? And Richard Pearl said, and the problem is? And I'm dead serious. You see, part of this Pax Americana talks about failed nations and failed regions. And in the mindset of the neoconservatives right now, who have control of the national security of the United States, they view the Middle East as a failed region. They say that the Middle East is imprisoned by centuries-old traditions of theocracy and feudalism, and that what needs to happen in the Middle East is a revolution that kicks out these old habits and brings in Western-style liberal democracy along the American model. Now, I'm a student of history, and I tell you what, I love my country and I love American democracy. I recognize it's not perfect, but we have a lot, we can improve on this greatly. But I do know one thing. When that Constitution was signed, you know, a lot happened between then and now. We fought a revolution. We fought a civil war. We fought two world wars. We emancipated the slaves. Women won suffrage. We had a civil rights struggle. We had the horrors of the Vietnam War. We have much going on. What this means is that the American democracy today is reflective of over 220 years of uniquely American experience. And it is the height of arrogance to suggest that we can take this model and cookie cutter apply it on other nations without considering their own unique experience.
And that was Scott Ritter, former United Nations Chief Weapons Inspector in Iraq, speaking on October 5th in Seattle. Ritter will be speaking in Binghamton next month on Tuesday, December 3rd, at the Anderson Center Concert Theater at Binghamton University. He will be speaking at 7 p.m. and at 9 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. Thank you. Bombs or Bread by Ethan Miller. Public opposition to an invasion of Iraq has been largely ignored by the Bush administration and Congress. If the present Bush follows his father's pattern of 10 years ago, he will launch an invasion and then attempt to browbeat opposition into silence with a call to support our troops. This is quite effective, especially in areas such as ours where poverty has forced many people into the service in search of a livelihood or money for college. Those waging peace are calling directly on those in the military to refuse deployment to Iraq. David Wiggins attended West Point and York Medical College. During Operation Desert Storm, he left the Army as a conscientious objector. He is currently an emergency room physician. On October 11th, he published the following open letter to U.S. troops. Wiggins wrote, "Dear soldier of the U.S. military, considering the common practice of talking about supporting the troops in times of hostilities, I should let you know how I feel. With all due respect, I want you to know that if you participate in this conflict, you are not serving me, and I don't support you. Speaking for myself, I feel those who participate will be damaging my reputation as an American and further endangering me and my children by creating hatred that will someday be returned to us, perhaps someday soon. Your actions will not lead to a safer world, but a more dangerous world of preemption and unilateral decisions to commit mayhem. I don't support that. This talk of supporting the troops is just another method our government uses to manipulate and control us. I don't support the troops, but I certainly fear for the lives of the troops. I would support the troops staying home. I regret that our so-called leaders have involved the troops in such a foolish, misguided undertaking. I would support the troops disobeying orders. I feel sorry for the troops' families. I would support the troops if they realized the best way to defend their families would be to stay alive and healthy and resist this war. The only people the troops are possibly serving are those who agree with this act of military aggression. Perhaps you are not even serving them if they end up suffering retribution for your actions. Oh yes, and you are serving the President, of course, the man who avoided combat duty and deserted his National Guard unit. You are serving the man who enriched himself through crony capitalism, shady accounting practices, and insider trading while running multiple corporations into bankruptcy. You will be serving the man who lost the popular vote for president, but was handed the presidency by a Supreme Court influenced by his father and through voting irregularities in a state governed by his brother. You will be serving the man who, as president, turned the budget surplus into a deficit and presided over the largest stock market decline since the Great Depression. You will be serving the man who unilaterally withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, ignored the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and rejected the International Criminal Court and Kyoto Protocol on global warming. If you are involved in an invasion of Iraq, you will be faced with some difficult ethical decisions. Are the Iraqi foot soldiers really the guilty party here? Is it reasonable to expect them to refuse orders to defend themselves against an invading force, you? Is this conflict really necessary at all? If not, why kill these people? If it is, are there other means our commander-in-chief and others are not exploring that might prevent you from having to kill these people, and possibly civilians too, and possibly die yourself or contribute to your friend's death? I'm glad I don't have to make those decisions. I feel for you and the difficult decisions you must make. I hope this note frees you of any sense of obligation to serve me you must feel, and helps you make a conscientious decision that you will be proud to accept complete responsibility for making. Please pass the sentiments I expressed in this letter on to your fellow soldiers. And that was a message to the troops, resist, from David Wiggins, published on Alternet, October 11, 2002. If you or a loved one need help in getting out of the military or becoming a conscientious objector to an invasion for plunder and profit in Iraq, assistance and counseling are available from the Central Committee on Conscientious Objection. GIs or family members can contact their toll-free GI Rights hotline at 800-394-9544. That's 800-394-9544. Or get more information on the web at www.objector.org. That's objector.org, and that's objector with an O-R at the end.
Young people should stand up for the rights of citizens and do what they believe. But I think this war is bullshit. I think something needs to happen about it.
That's how the country operates.
Violence is not the answer.
To prevent war with Iraq. They should have been doing this when they were making war on our people and obliterating our people and taking our resources. They based the Constitution on the great law of peace, the Iroquois Confederacy. But they didn't follow the principles that the great law of peace follows. And it says all men are created equal. But according to the United States Constitution, that doesn't mean the red man, the brown man, the black man, or the poor man, or any women. What they're talking about is all rich men are created equal, or all noblemen are created. And I think that's how they interpret it.
Imperialist policies that began when they got here and landed at Plymouth Rock. It's not changed a bit. Expansion all the way across. The earth is round. They ran out of places to go, and now they're looking for places to take more from. It's about money, power, and control. It's about greed. The corruption of extreme greed. That's what it's really about. That's what they're all about. All of them have been fights over territory and what's in the land. Whether it's minerals or oil, what the land will grow. Bananas in Central America, coffee, can't make any difference. These people just don't have any end to their greed. They will never be satisfied, never. You need to bring them under control. Any control needs to be done with masses of the people. You need to control the corporate capital class, because they're really out of hand now.
The genocidal policies of the United States government is still continuing, and it's going worldwide.
Bush is the new Columbus, and globalization and the whole routine that he has developing for Iraq, the war on terrorism. Indigenous people are accustomed to being labeled as terrorists, whether foreign or domestic. And so we see this as an extension of the plan that Columbus began in 1492. So it's encouraging to see all these people out here saying that we're drawing a line against that kind of policy, globalization and oppression, the hierarchy of rich against poor, north against south, in terms of northern hemisphere against southern hemisphere, rich countries against poor countries. That's the whole legacy of Columbus. We're hoping that this momentum continues until October the 12th, when in the birthplace of Columbus Day, we're going to come out here again and say, it's time to put an end to this. It's time to put an end to this legacy and envision a new future, not only for Denver, not only for the United States, but for the hemisphere and for the world. All this war is about what it's always been about who's in the way. Who's in the way of capitalist expansion? Who's in the way of the New World Order? In 1492, Columbus represented the New World Order. In 2002, Bush represents the New World Order. And anybody who gets in the way gets pushed out of the way, gets destroyed, because you are the enemy. Bush has been very clear about that. You're either with him or you're against him. Columbus said the same thing to those Taino Indians. You're either with us or you're against us. You either get baptized or we'll slaughter you. And that's exactly what they did. So this is definitely the new colonialism, the new imperialism. No question about that. This is a continuation, the newest chapter in that book.
That was Columbus Mix by D-Bomb. You might want to get something to write with, as there are a number of interesting events coming up this week. Yesterday, Pacifica Radio carried an 8-hour live broadcast from the peace marches in Washington and elsewhere. However, no radio station in our community made this important news event available to us. Instead, we were presented with college sports, game shows, car repair, brief and inaccurate reports of the demonstration from corporate-sponsored National Public Radio, or, of course, a wide selection of music and Christian fundamentalist proselytizing. If you, as I, wish there would be a radio station that would consider such an event as yesterday's protests a top priority, please support Ithaca Community Radio, whose goal is the ultimate creation of such a station. Please visit www.ithacaradio.org to find out how to contribute. Or come to the City Lights Antiques Big 3-Day Barn Sale next weekend, as part of the proceeds will go towards paying for Ithaca Community Radio's new, more powerful transmitter broadcasting on 88.1 in Ithaca, Dryden, Cortland, Danby, and Brooktondale. Everything must go, the barn must be cleared out. Lots of furniture, home accessories, antiques in the rough, including oak dressers, a large oak file, tables, lamps, a library table, office desks, chairs, a drop leaf table, a glass and wood showcase, wing chairs, a china cabinet, architecturals, doors, old bathtubs, sinks and fixtures, a tub surround, knickknacks, weird stuff, valuable junk, funk and fun. The sale runs November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day. City Lights Antiques is located at 1319 Mecklenburg Road in Ithaca, at the top of West Hill on Route 79 West, 2 miles from the old Octopus. Visit the Glass Art Studio and browse the showroom stocked with tons of great antiques. Bring your pets, bring the kids, or come up just for the view of IC and Cornell. Call area code 607-272-3667 for more information. A forum on international student visas will be held on the Cornell campus on Tuesday, October 29th at 11 a.m. in the Founders Room of Annabelle Taylor Hall. The events of September 11th have led to heightened concern in the U.S. about threats to national security posed by immigration. This has affected the international student community both at Cornell and across the country, in terms of students being denied visas and those with visas having difficulty returning to the United States. The speakers will be Brendan O'Brien, director of the ISSO, Kent Hubble, the dean of students, Anka Wessels, director of CRESP. Speakers will take questions from the audience following their presentations. And later that same day, also on the Cornell campus, Nadia Hijab, author and development consultant, will be speaking on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, applying human rights and the law to action for just peace. This event takes place at 4:30 p.m. Tuesday, October 29th at the Kaufman Auditorium in Goldwin Smith Hall. The event is free. The HEN Art and Activism Tour will be coming to Ithaca on Wednesday, October 30th. From 12 to 6 p.m. at the Clark Lounge at Ithaca College, there will be free workshops, presentations, and events with nationally known artist revolutionaries. The workshop events are, from 12 to 2, Creative Careering, from 2 to 4, Challenging White Supremacy, and at 4 p.m. there will be a film, Senorita Extraviada. Workshops will be followed by a concert at 7 p.m. at the Women's Community Building in downtown Ithaca at the corner of Cayuga and Seneca Streets. The concert is a benefit for the HEN Foundation and is suitable for all ages. There's a sliding scale donation from $7 to $20. Please join Great Hudson Clearwater headliners Ember Swift and Pamela Means, nationally touring artist activists Jolie Rickman, Colleen Katow, and Liz Guy, and New York City-based indigenous theater troupe Kotlikue at this an evening of powerful, upbeat arts with a message of peace. The HEN Foundation supports artists and activists nationwide. For more information on the HEN Foundation, visit www.henfoundation.org. For more information on the event, call area code 607-255-7293. Videotaped copies of the local cable access television program Ithaca Democratic Socialists of America Presents will now be available at the Alternatives Library. The Alternatives Library is located in Annabelle Taylor Hall on the Cornell campus. Available at the library now is the program Stop War in Iraq, in which Lucas Shapiro talks with Chip Gagnon, assistant professor in politics at Ithaca College, about the impending war in Iraq, why it's a bad idea, and what people can do to stop it. The program that will air next week is also already available, Jail Expansion or Not, an interview with Pete Myers, candidate for sheriff of Tompkins County, focusing on the arguments against expanding the county jail. In closing, here's a brief item concerning Vice President Dick Cheney, the man in possession of the black box that could launch nuclear war. This item is from All Places Newsweek of October 21st, 2002. The title is Cheney, Investigators Keep Out, by Michael Isikoff and Tamara Lipper. The Vice President blocks an independent commission to investigate 9/11. Dick Cheney played a behind-the-scenes role last week in derailing an agreement to create an independent commission to investigate the 9/11 attacks. Last month, the White House endorsed the formation of the panel, but on Thursday, hours after congressional negotiators hailed a final deal over the scope and powers of a 9/11 panel, Cheney called House Intelligence Committee Chairman Representative Porter Goss, sources told Newsweek. Later that day, Goss told a closed-door conference committee that he couldn't accept the deal, citing instructions from, quote, above my pay grade. Goss later said he was referring to other House leaders, not Cheney. Goss wouldn't discuss his call from the VP, but said it wasn't the determining factor in his stand. Cheney's office said the VP's only instruction to Goss was to keep negotiating, and Bushies insist they still hope to hammer out a new deal before Congress goes home this week. One obstacle, subpoena power. Last week's proposed deal would allow any 5 members of the 10-member panel to subpoena documents, including internal White House intelligence briefs. But White House officials say this would allow congressional Democrats, who will control half the appointees, to, quote, politicize the commission. Cheney strongly opposes the idea of any independent bodies poking into the White House's conduct. He has repeatedly objected to efforts by a separate Joint Intelligence Committee inquiry to obtain documents and interview key witnesses, including an FBI informant who lived with 2 of the 9/11 hijackers. Bush officials insist the VP's stand is based on principle, not fear of embarrassments. Even some congressional critics tend to agree. There is just this general philosophical orientation that the less the world knows, the better, says one GOP staffer. And that, from Newsweek of October 21, 2002, Cheney, Investigators Keep Out, by Michael Isikoff and Tamara Lipper, an indication of how badly the excrement is smelling. That's it for tonight's program, leaving you with some food for thought.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.